Well, welcome back to Coast. For the next couple hours, we're going to let your mind wander. Julia Mossbridge with us, and we will talk about the premonition code. Premonition, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Our guest, Julia Mossbridge, doctor, a PhD, is a futurist trained in cognitive neuroscience, a fellow at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, a visiting scholar at Northwestern University in the Department of Psychology. Dr. Mossbridge is the author of Transcendent Mind, one of the first academic books to examine paranormal experiences. Her research focuses on precognition and the possibility of time travel. Julia, welcome to the show, and I look forward to seeing you at Conscious Life this coming in February.
Yeah, hi, George. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. And, yep, February in L.A. Yeah.
Look, you're looking forward to that as well. Did you ever come across the works of my late aunt, Dr. Shafika Caregula, by any chance?
No. Is it in the future?
She wrote a book years ago called Breakthrough to Creativity. And let me tell you a little bit about her, Julia. She's a medical-trained doctor, psychiatrist, and she decided to make her entire practice in the area of telepathy. She was obsessed with it, and she changed her practice. That's what she wanted to study. She moved out to Los Angeles and set up a shop, and that's what she did. She wrote several books, but studied telepathy and was just groundbreaking when it came to that. But you two would hit it off. She loved this subject matter.
She sounds cool. She was an MD?
She was a medical doctor who trained psychiatrist, tragically died when a radio, of all things, fell in her bathtub where she was taking a bath and electrocuted her.
Wow.
Horrible story.
Wow.
And, we would converse a little bit before I started doing this show, just doing my local stuff. But she was one of a kind. Anyway, tell us a little bit more about you.
Wow. Well, I've been a scientifically minded person since I was a kid, and my dad was a physicist, and he always encouraged me to sort of try to look at the underlying mechanics of things. But I didn't get interested in the human mind, I think, until I started looking back on my own dreams and realizing that I was having precognitive dreams. Before I was 10 years old, I realized I was having precognitive dreams, and then I started recording them in journals. And because I knew enough, I guess because of my dad, and maybe also because of my mom, who is a social worker, I knew enough to recognize that there was something going on with these dreams, and I was having detailed enough dreams that one wouldn't expect to have those coincidences sort of by chance, right? I was thinking of them as coincidences, and I was thinking, well, it's really difficult to explain them by chance. And so I continued on to learn neuroscience and learn then cognitive neuroscience, which is all about how does the mind relate to the brain, really. And then I just said, I want to start all the way through graduate school, and I said, I want to start checking into what this precognition thing really is. And I finally just threw myself at that problem instead of trying to solve other problems related to time in the brain.
How did your colleagues react to your decision to go into that direction?
Well, yeah. So let's see, I was at Northwestern University at the time, which is what they call a Tier 1 research institution, which means it gets lots of government grants for research. And I was a postdoc, and I thought, well, I'm only going to go and be a postdoc, which means you go in a lab and do work after you have your PhD, so you get more training. It's like you're in school for the 11 millionth year, basically. And I thought, well, I'm only going to do that if I can get a grant to look at precognition, because that's really interesting to me, and this other stuff is a little less interesting, I'll tell you. So I did. I was able to get a grant to look at that, not from the U.S. government, but from a nonprofit called the BIAL Foundation, the BIAL in Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pharmaceutical company that has a founder who's very interested in parapsychology. And so I said, all right, if I get that grant, I'll do this. And I did. And so I came into the lab with money, but not from the usual source. And when you come into a lab with money at a research institution that basically operates on grant money, you have a little respect because, hey, you're bringing money, right? But at the same time, what am I bringing money for? You know, looking into precognition. Luckily, the guy whose lab I came into was really open-minded. He had been trained in physics, and a lot of physicists are more open-minded about this stuff than psychologists and neuroscientists. So he said, okay, well, you know, you got to try to do it, and if it works, it works, and then we'll see. And then in the meantime, he encouraged me to look at mainstream things that could help me get another grant in the future. So I did both of those things. And my colleagues outside of the lab were generally very skeptical. And when I started trying to look for an academic job out in the world, you know, as a professor,
yep,
I was basically told, if you want one, you're going to take that off your resume. Anything
yeah.
has to do with predicting the future.
I thought so. Yep. They just did not want to see that, did they?
No, and they said, well, you're, you know, they were sort of wondering why I just didn't do that in the first place. They said, you have all these other stuff, you could get a job based on the other stuff, but people, as soon as people see that, you know, they're explaining to me as if I don't understand. As soon as people see that stuff, they don't want to give you a job, and I had to explain to them because they didn't understand. I said, this is the stuff I want to do for the rest of my life. The other stuff is stuff that I'm not interested in, so there's no way I'm going to try to apply for a job doing stuff that I'm not that interested in and take off the most interesting work, you know? So. Yeah.
But the other stuff would pay the bills, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, I was lucky enough to think, well, I have sort of a backup, which is I'm good at technology development, and I'm smart at figuring out, you know, machine learning and artificial intelligence stuff. So I kind of thought I could just get a job doing that if no one ends up hiring me to do the stuff I want to do, and then I'll do the stuff I want to do on the side.
Let's talk about precognition and give us, Julia, your definition, first of all, of what you believe it is.
Sure, and I should back up and say it's not about that I was smart enough, but just that I had been trained in that stuff, and that made it good.
All right.
Okay, what is precognition?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so precognition is predicting future events, getting accurate information about future events that are not predictable by sensory perception. So it's not like I hear the rumble of thunder and I predict that it's raining outside, right? So that's just, you know, standard logic.
Is it extrasensory perception?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be, because I don't know how else to explain it. If you take someone into a lab and they can, their body changes, like heartbeat or rate of breathing, based on a random number generator's choice of a future picture that they see, right?
Exactly.
So that's precognition. Is that no one on the planet knows what's about to happen, yet your body or your mind is changing based on that future thing.
Do you have to be psychic to have precognitive abilities?
No. Most people have precognitive abilities and have no, including skeptics, have precognitive abilities and have no idea that they have them. In fact, most precognition is happening without your knowledge and just on a daily basis. And then some of it becomes conscious every once in a while, and you say, oh, isn't it weird? You know, oh, isn't it weird? I had this dream about whatever, you know, I had a dream about someone flushing their dog down the toilet, and the next day someone flushed their dog down the toilet or whatever it was.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. It was pretty horrible. It just came into my head. But yeah, if you take a room full of people, on average, you're going to be able to show that they have precognitive ability, but not conscious precognitive ability. Trying to get people who actually have conscious precognitive ability, which means they're willing to listen to what's going on unconsciously, and they've trained themselves to take that seriously and use it consciously, that's a much harder deal.
Julia, is it a little like remote viewing? Would you put remote viewing in that category?
Yeah, well, actually, so much of remote viewing is precognition.
Yeah.
That when I in my book Premonition Code with Teresa Chung, we decided to make a whole chapter about what we call controlled precognition, which is a kind of remote viewing where the event that you're viewing, like the target, as they say in remote viewing, is not known by anyone until the future. And so much of remote viewing is that way, especially remote viewing that has to do with like predicting the stock market or whatever it is, right? Something that's going to happen in the future, no one knows what it is. So much of remote viewing is that way that we're confident to, that we can use, you know, the decades of history and scientific evidence about remote viewing that has occurred in order to explain people how to make their precognition conscious.
A couple weeks ago, we had the Mega Millions lotto drawing, and it was about $1.4 billion.
Yeah.
Why can't a great person who's got incredible precognitive abilities see those lottery numbers and go buy the ticket?
You know,
now there was one winner. Maybe he had precognitive abilities. Who knows?
Well, actually, so it's sort of there's sort of two answers to that question. So one is a great person who has that ability could, and in fact, in Virginia last year did have a guy in Virginia who was a computer engineer who'd never had a dream like that before, had a dream of five numbers and just thought, well, seems like I should enter the lottery. And he entered four times, and he won $400,000, I think. It was
Not bad.
Yeah, it was nice. But in terms of consciously being able to do that, that's been tried. That's a pretty difficult task because with a lottery, you know what's weird about precognition? The more information you have about it, the less good you're likely to be about it at it when you're doing conscious precognition. In a dream, you're better off because you're asleep and it's just coming to you. But when you're sitting down at a desk with some paper and a pen and you want to do controlled precognition and you know that you're trying to predict a future event, if you actually have a bunch of choices in front of you, like the numbers 1 through, you know, 67 or whatever it is, it's actually much harder. You're better off completely not knowing what you're looking at all. You're better off if you could somehow not know that you're trying to predict the lottery.
I do sometimes mind games with people based on picking numbers from 1 to 5, where you have a 20% chance of picking that number, obviously. And so, you know, I'll have 10 people lined up, and I'll do it and try to send them the number. And then I said, you know, take the first number that hits your head. Don't think about it.
Right.
And interesting, with what should be 20%, right, 10 people, 2 people should get it right.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've had 4 or 5 people get it right.
Yeah.
And that kind of defies odds, doesn't it?
Well, it depends on how many times you get 4 or 5 people to do that. But, yeah, it would defy odds. I could quickly do a calculation, but I could tell you how many people.
Well, and the more people, Julia, that you know well, the easier it becomes for some reason. I have found that.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly some of the research on telepathy. So that's really telepathy. Or I guess I should say that's probably telepathy. Because, first of all, there's decent, in fact, very good evidence for telepathy. And second of all, in any case where the telepathy can happen, I assume it is happening. So telepathy can happen in situations where someone knows the answer right then, and they're furthermore, they have some kind of relationship with you.
I'll do an experiment later with our audience, though I won't have the total number in order to compare. Based on the 20%, we'll see if anybody gets it right and see what they think. We'll do a little mind thing like that.
Well, if we could do it without something that's called a forced choice, so 1 to 5 is a forced choice, but if instead we do it with like an image where it could be anything in the world, that's going to actually probably produce more impressive results.
Interesting. Okay. And I would think of the image, whatever it is, and try to transmit it.
You could pull up some, you know, stock photography website and look at the first image on the website.
Great. We can do that. What do you mean by positive precogs in your work?
Oh, yeah. So one of the reasons we were wanting to write the book is because I had this dream a couple years back of a devastating terrorist strike in Kuwait City. And in the dream, it was people were praying at a mosque, and it was noontime prayers. This was all in the dream. I didn't even know much about
in Kuwait City, of all places.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't know much about Islam or anything, but in the dream, it was sort of laid out in front of me. I actually had a narrator who was taking me through the event. And visually in front of my eyes in the dream, I saw the date of the event. And they woke up, and it was a horrible dream, just the loss of life. And anyway, then that date occurred, which was just the next day. And then the event happened. And I felt so helpless. And that was the first really world event precognitive dream that I had had. Before that, it had been.
What year was the event?
I can't remember. It was 2015 or 2016. It was.
Oh, just recent then. Okay.
Kuwait City, okay. Kuwait bombing. Yeah.
My daughter had a precog dream about 9/11. Back in 2001, she didn't know what it was, but she called me up one day, a couple days before it happened, and said, "Dad, I just had the strangest dream. I'm walking in this big metropolitan city. We didn't know where it was. And all this dust and stuff and debris is falling down on me, and I look down at my feet, and I'm buried in about 6 inches of this stuff." And she said, "I think some city's going to get hit by a volcano or something." Yeah, that's what
she going to think of it?
Yeah, that's what she thought. And then 9/11 happens, and I remember her calling me at home, waking me up, saying, "Dad, you got to turn on television. Turn on television, please." And I'm going, "Wendy, what are you talking about? You know the way you are when you wake up." And she said, "Please turn it on." And I did, and then I saw the second plane hit the building. And I went, "My God." But then I saw the rubble coming down. And she and I agreed that that's what she was dreaming about.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't know what it was. She didn't know where it was. But she had that picture. Now, how did that picture enter her mind like that, Julia?
Okay, yeah. So many good questions. So first of all, that kind of experience and not knowing what to do with it is exactly why we created this idea of what's called a positive precog. So someone who's using precognition to help change the world in a positive way. And so to help humanity in a positive way. And we want to be able, people to have those dreams that become very clear and disturbing, and also even waking experiences that are clear and disturbing and people don't know what to do with. We want them to have something to do with those things. So if we can create a culture where precognition is no longer taboo, and where there are maybe a national database of people who have these intuitions, precognitions, these dreams, that can be weeded through. You know, we could use artificial intelligence or something to weed through them. Who in the past has been successful? Okay, we're going to weight those with a higher weighting. And so if someone who's been consistently successful has this dream about a shooting in Las Vegas. You start to take it more seriously than if 10 people do, you take it even more seriously, things like that. So that's a positive precog, is someone who is committed to improving their precognitive accuracy to the point where they can actually use it to help law enforcement or help the world in their area of the world be a better place. And so that's what a positive precog is. But then your question about where does this come from? Where does the information come from? So first of all, no one knows the answer to that, but there are ideas.
Okay, hold on right there. We'll talk about those ideas when we come back in a moment, Julia, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Dr. Julia Mossbridge with us, of course, and we will take your calls next hour, questions, and if you've had a precognitive story you want to share with us, please go ahead. So, Julia, we're talking about where does precognition come from. Do you think it comes from the individual, the physical brain, or does it come from outside of that, or is there some kind of spirit or something giving us the information?
Well, so I think this is the clearest answer, and the most correct answer is I have no idea, and then I have all sorts of ideas.
Let's listen to all of them.
Yeah. Okay, here's all the ideas. So one idea is that the brain itself, the brain matters in terms of there's some kind of relationship between our brains and our minds. We don't know what that relationship is. The traditional story is that the activity in your brain is causing your mental experience, right?
Right.
But we don't know if the traditional...
No, and scientists will tell you if the brain dies, everything goes.
Right. And some scientists will tell you that.
Yeah.
not this particular one.
Or most of them, I guess.
Yeah, right. Most of the ones I know would say that. But I think there's... I mean, I know there's enough evidence, at least to convince me, that there's something going on about that is remaining conscious after someone's brain dies. So to me, that's not a good explanation. But there is something. There is some relationship between the brain and the mind. I mean, if you know anyone who has in your family or among your friends has had any kind of like a stroke or any kind of neurological problem, you can see the change in their behavior from before to after. And so it's not like the brain doesn't have anything to do with the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So one hypothesis could be that, you know, the brain actually is, all right, here, get this, it's, think of a very flat pool of water, and you drop a stone in that flat pool of water, and the ripples go out in all directions. They don't just go out in one direction, they go out in all directions. And that, I think the brain could work that way, where something happens in the brain, like an event, you know, 9/11 happens and the brain is having this wild emotional experience. Even just watching it on TV, it's an emotional experience.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and think of that as a pebble dropping into the pond, and it's going out in all directions in time. So it's going both forward and backward. So one answer to the question of where is this coming from is, well, you're reading your own future mind. You're reading for your own future brain. Your brain itself is having responses that are moving in both directions in time when there's an important event going on, and you're tapping into it somehow. So it's kind of the answer could be it's from your brain or it's from your mind in the future.
I would like to think it's from your mind in the future. To me, it's got that more supernatural flow to it.
Well, not only supernatural, but it's a lot easier to think about the mind, which is really just the mental activity that goes on, as being able to process things in both directions in time, because we're used to physical things moving in one direction in time. So you and I are thinking the same way, because I just think it's just more intuitive. But, you know, physical objects, we feel like they follow certain rules, and they seem to follow the rules that say that they're kind of going in a linear temporal sense. But mental things, well, we're hopping around all the time. You know, we've got memories that you listen to a song and all of a sudden a memory comes back from, you know, the first time you made out or something. And that's hopping around in time. And so why wouldn't we also be able to do that forward in time, really kind of memories of the future? So to me, that's the best guess. So other people have asked me, well, you know, is it some kind of spirit that's giving you this information? Well, that's really hard to test, but that's another hypothesis you
mm-hmm.
have to figure out.
You can't rule it out.
You can't rule it out. And frankly, given the work in mediumship and the information that the truthful information, the accurate information that trained and skilled tested mediums are able to provide about people who have died. And a lot of that work is by the Windbridge Institute, by the way. You ought to check them out if you don't know them. They're great. But the Windbridge Institute has shown that people who are mediums who are thoroughly vetted can give information about what they call sitters. That's someone coming to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? For a loved one, even when they don't have any contact with the sitter and they're given these questions, you know, on a piece of paper, and all the questions are the same for each person. They can so all the questions are like, what did this person do? What is their hair color? Stuff like that. They can provide accurate information, you know, at a rate higher than chance. And that's been replicated. So it seems to me, all right, there could be something going on with this consciousness existing after death and actually being able to communicate back to living people. And if so, maybe we could, in certain cases, get that information from something that's beyond time, something that's beyond the body and therefore likely beyond time.
Have you studied people in a laboratory with these kinds of situations?
So not with the spirit stuff, but because I don't know how to test that in the lab, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. But
mm-hmm.
certainly with just precognition in the lab, that's all the work I do in precognition is laboratory work or online experiments that are testing precognition. Yeah, yeah, and that's what I do, and it's pretty neat. Most people think that they have an ability, but they can't demonstrate it in the laboratory, and some people can learn to have an ability. But the farther away you go from these forced choices, you know, is it A or B? Is it one of these 10 things? And closer to remote viewing, which is more open, you know, try to describe the image, the more likely you are to get significant results. And with the remote viewing-like stuff, which I call controlled precognition because no one knows what the future event is, what's really interesting to me about it is you can do laboratory experiments on that. You just have to have a comparison set. So, you know, if someone draws a picture and says, I think this is the image, well, you have to compare that between that, you know, the target image and some other image, and you need independent judges to do that, or you need the person themselves to do it. And so what I decided to do is create a website where people could actually try this themselves, and they can judge their own abilities to do this. And also an app where they could judge their ability.
Oh, great. Now, how do they get to that?
Oh, sure. That website is thepremonitioncode.com.
Okay. And we've got a link for you on that at coasttocoastam.com.
Yeah, yeah. And it has a thing called the Positive Precog Training, and that's what I'm talking about.
All right.
Click on Positive Precog Training. It actually takes you through the steps. The book in more detail takes you through the steps, but this is like headlines, which you may or may not understand unless you read the book. But it takes you through all the steps, and then it'll have a random number generator that chooses two graphs that indicate the contents of two different pictures. The graphs are telling you what proportion of each of the things are in the picture. So, like, how much water is there, how much, you know, fire is there, how much, how many people are there, that kind of thing. And then you choose which graph most matches your sense of what the picture will be. Once you choose, then a random number generator presents you with a picture. We can actually try it if you want to, or we could ask the audience to try
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah, and they can email me, and then I'll have the results later, and I'll share them with you later on, Julia.
Sounds great.
Are some people better than others with precognition, and if so, why?
Oh, yeah, it does seem that some people are rock stars right off the bat, and sometimes they don't know it. And oftentimes they do. Oftentimes they've had precognitive dreams or waking experiences of precognitive compulsions. Do you know what I mean when I say precognitive compulsion?
Tell us what that is.
Okay. So if you talk to someone who has been in the services and who has been through something difficult or been in law enforcement and been through some, you know, scary situation. Where
tragic, something like that.
Yeah. Oftentimes they'll tell you a story about, you know, God, I just had this feeling that I had to get up at that moment and leave where I was, mm-hmm. do something else. And then when they come back, they realize, you know, that area was under attack or something horrible had happened there. That's a precognitive compulsion. You don't know why. It's not like in your head you're thinking, oh, I should get up now because someone's about to come attack this area, right? It's just a compulsion to do something with no information about why, but it's so strong and so clear that people do it. That's a precognitive compulsion, and that's, to me, very interesting, not only because I've had them in my own life, but because I think it saves a lot of people's lives, and a lot of people don't know it, that that's what's going on. I say it's just an intuition or a funny feeling, but a lot of those people could end up being very skilled at controlled precognition. And in terms of learning, you know, my impression is that there are naturals, just like, it's like musical talent. There are naturals. When they sit down at a piano, you give them a little bit of instruction, and they start playing really beautifully. And that most people are more like your usual person. Like when I sat down on the piano the first time, it took me weeks and months to figure out this is how I'm supposed to put my fingers and stuff. But I had to practice. And if you practice, you can at least get somewhat better, if not a lot better.
Right. Exactly. It's like me with the clarinet, but I never mastered it as a kid.
Yeah, I never mastered the piano. But I got better, you know? I could be decent, right?
The ability to do precognitive things.
Yeah.
And again, some people are better than others, and it's obvious. Is it a good thing or a bad thing when they have these hunches and they know? They just know how to act and react. It kind of gives them a leg up on other people and gives them that added benefit. But I don't see anything wrong with that. Do you? I mean, if you have that innate ability to be precognitive, use it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm right there with you. I have been noticing, I'm traveling around the country doing a book tour about premonition code, and I have been noticing that some people have negative associations with it, or they think it's the devil's work, or, it's just, you shouldn't mess with that area. And I think that having accurate precognition is so rare that it is probably a gift. It's probably much more like a gift than some kind of bad thing that you've done. And I agree that if you can use it, that's great. But I think there's a lot of people who think, either the future is set in stone, and so you're just helpless. And so if you dream of some kind of car crash or something, all you can do is just, cringe and wait for some horrible car crash. And there's other people who think, oh, I have total control of the future. And if I have this dream, then I can completely change it. And then if they're not able to change it, they feel depressed or like, oh, I failed. I think those are kind of the two extremes.
Well, take us through this, Julia. I've got an object in mind that I want to transmit to people. And they can email me at george@coasttocoastam.com, and I'll have some of the results when we come back for the next hour. And I'll tell you if anybody got it right or not. And we'll go from there. But take us through it. I've got the object. I'm ready to send it mentally. But take me through the techniques to do this to people.
Okay, so that's telepathy, because you already have the object in mind.
Yes.
So that's different from precognition. So if you wanted to do precognition, what you would do is you'd say, I don't yet have an object in mind, but after, at a certain time, after a particular time, maybe 25 minutes from now or whatever it is that you wanted, you'd say, then I would go discover what the object is, just like...
All right, well, we don't have 25 minutes to wait, so...
Yeah. So this time we're going to do what's called telepathy plus precognition, which means some people are going to pick it up by tapping into your mind.
Okay.
Some people are going to pick it up by tapping into their future self.
When do I send it to people?
Why don't you
mentally?
Why don't you send it during the next break?
Okay, or we can do it now.
Yeah, we can do it now, but what I'm saying is that for people picking up on it, for listeners, you might consider, instead of trying to read George's mind, you might consider trying to read your own mind in the future when you'll know. So if you could tell them when they're going to know what it is, they could try to read their own mind at that time.
Well, all right. In that case, I'm going to tell them what it is when we come back after the top of the hour break.
Okay, cool.
I'll tell them
great.
Exactly what it is. And in the meantime, I'd like them to email me now what they think it is.
Okay, so here's how they can do that. So what they can do is get into a calm place, sort of inside, and imagine that if you're driving, don't take your hands off the wheel, of course, but imagine...
And don't close your eyes.
and no one close your eyes, because I don't want anyone to think of closing their eyes just in case someone's driving. Imagine you've got your hands in front of you like a bowl, like in the shape of a bowl, and that bowl is just going to sit there, and the first thing that comes into that bowl, the first thing that your mind's eye imagines coming into that bowl from the future, from after the break, just intend that you're going to see or sense something that comes into that bowl, which has to do with what George is going to say the object is after the break. Have that be the thing. And
okay.
Trust that.
And I have mentally projected it out to the ether. So let's see if it gets picked up. But email me, folks, as soon as you can, when you have that object in your mind, at george@coasttocoastam.com. I'll tell you what the object is when we come back after the break. And then we'll also go through the emails very quickly with Julia to see if anybody got it right. And we shall find out. Now, in terms of logical odds, it's a better test than my 1 to 5 thing, right?
Yeah, well, in terms of logical odds, it's going to be complex to calculate the odds, because some people are going to have adjectives that match. They're not going to have nouns. They'll have, it's something, I'm not going to say an adjective because that'll bias people, but it's some kind of adjective that has to do with the object, but they haven't named the object. And that's considered close, but not exactly right on, right? So then you have to calculate sort of a partial odd. See, we're not going to be able to calculate the statistics here, but we're going to get a sense. Some people will probably get the object or something very close to it, and other people will have something that's like the shape of it or the color of it or the feel.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see how many people get it right. And,
yeah.
Hopefully I won't get 10,000 emails in the next 5 minutes, but just enough to sort through them and see what we might be able to do. But it's fascinating. But you don't think it's illegal to use it for your advantage in life if you have this ability?
No, it's a great, yeah, I mean, that's one of the great things. You know, there's a whole list of ethics that we go through in the book because, of course, using it to hurt people is not ethical.
No.
But certainly using it to help yourself is ethical, as long as, you know, you're not using it to help yourself in a way that hurts
you. All right, super. All right, stay with us, Julia. We're going to give you one more shot to send me the email that I'm cutting it off, and then I'll tell you what the object is at the top of the hour. But George at coast2coastam.com. What came to your mind? We'll be back with Julia Mossbridge. We'll take your calls and your precognitive stories next on Coast to Coast AM.